Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner. Unfortunately, Tony's not with us today. He's still recovering after a long illness. But we have Sean McNally doing the interview with me. And the interview is James Montgomery.
Glad to be here. Love you guys.
Thank you, James. It's been a while. I haven't seen you for quite a while myself.
Yeah, count your blessings is what I always say.
Yeah.
Could have been worse. You could have seen me last night anyway.
You were in Plymouth, I heard.
Yeah. We do an annual Saturday after Thanksgiving. We always sell out. The crowd always goes nuts, and it's a great venue.
It's fun when it's a crowd that really love what you do, and just put you the energy, get the energy back. That's where I want to start with before we start talking about channel stuff. I want to start with James. And James, you were a Detroit laddie, and Barbara was a Detroit lass. And we wanted to know exactly when did you start playing harmonica and listening to the blues? Was it the blues from England or was it the blues from America?
No, it was American blues. I started out in a jug band. The first time I heard live blues, and you know, Dinky, I had a radio station for 5 years and did about 100 interviews with blues musicians before I joined Johnny Winter's band for 6 years. And once I was on the road with Johnny for 6 years, I couldn't do my show anymore. And the reason I mention that is because I had a moment, the first time I heard blues harmonica, I had this moment. It was like this deep thing, and you know, deep inside my soul, as they say.
Yeah.
When I had my radio show, almost every blues musician that I interviewed, like 90% of them, I had a moment. Bonnie Raitt had hers at summer camp, and James Cotton had his on the plantation.
Yeah.
And so blues musicians, you know, we have a moment. I don't know if that happens with rock people. I think maybe they just want to play guitar and be in a band and, you know, wear Beatle boots and get girls or whatever. But all blues musicians have that moment. I had it when I was 15 years old, hearing live blues harmonica from a jug band, which I ended up, within a year, I was the front man of that jug band. And the guy who gave me my first harmonica, the first guy I heard play was Chris Mancio, who's the leader of the Uptown Horns.
I'm still
doing 10 shows a year with him, so we've been playing together for 60 years.
Amazing. Yeah. And you came out to Detroit to play in those funky clubs that are in Detroit at that time period. I saw some posters that Barbara posted.
It was a great time. You know, I think we all grew up at the right time, you know, but I don't know if other judge Christians can say that, but you know, there were great blues clubs in Detroit, and the ones that didn't have matinees or the ones that weren't coffee houses, you know, I could usually sneak in behind John Lee Hooker or something like that.
That's cool. I love it.
Yeah. So yeah, I met John Lee when I was 19, and of course I met all those guys back then at these places in Detroit. Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, Muddy Waters, Paul Butterfield. I met all those guys I met before I even left high school. But I was familiar with the Boston music scene because in those days AM stations could go up to like, I don't know, 50,000 or 100,000 watts, whatever it was. So I could get WLAC out of Nashville, the John R. Show, which was all blues, and I could also get BZ out of Boston, which had so I knew everything about the Boston music scene. So when I applied to college, I applied to Harvard and BU. Harvard said no, but BU said come on. So, you know, so I ended up at Boston University, and was thrilled to be it because Boston had probably the greatest music scene in the country back then.
By that time period, yeah, I think you're right. I think for me, when I first came over with Fleetwood Mac, I mean, some of the musicians that we encountered in Boston were just, wow, this is really good. And the Peter Green was like, yeah, let's go and have some fun with them. And we did jam a lot. That's with different people. And I'm saying that was the day.
I know, and I love it. There were so many places. You know, you had to make up your mind who you were going to see. You know, it's like, you know, did I go to the Jazz Workshop, Paul's Mall, the Catacombs, the Psychedelic Supermarket, the Tea Party? Because there were at the Club 47, there was a great band in every one of those places every night. It wasn't like, you know, living in the Des Moines where you go, well, there's only one place to see a band tonight, you know.
You're talking about the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then it changed in the 70s. Because when I first met you, you were on the circuit doing different shows. And, you know, just doing the circuit, but also touring, like you said, or touring with people and touring with this, that, and the other. And then the 80s came along, and I got fed up with it. Because...
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I got fed up with it myself because the audience was changing to be the people that were the entertainment, and the band on stage was just all and void, no matter how wonderful you played. And it was an era that changed in 79. I got B.B. King in Russia, and I got Ambrosia out on the road here. And I says, well, that's it, I'm done. And I decided to...
Well, you snuck back in there a few times here and there after that. I saw you off and on a little bit off of that after that period. But, you know, what happened to me was I got almost right out of college. My college band was really successful. I mean, my high school band, I opened up for Iggy and the Stooges and the MC5.
Yeah.
And then I went back to visit Detroit to help my family out. And that summer, I joined a band called the Gold Brothers, and we opened for Iggy and the Stooges again in the MC5. And I saw them invent punk rock right in front of me. But anyway.
MC5.
No, seriously. When Iggy did those stage dives, there was no waiting audience with open arms.
He would dive on the
storm fences that they had, the security fences, and impale himself and everything. But anyway, so my point is that, you know, so my band got signed by Capricorn Records to a six-figure multi-album deal just about out of college. And so what happened to me was I didn't really have a chance after my first year to play clubs anymore because, I was with Premier Talent with Barbara Skydell.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Exactly, you know, right behind Frank Barcelona. So maybe a year after college, I spent the next 10 years opening up. Every show I did was opening up for either Bruce Springsteen, Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Marshall Tucker, Steve Miller, you know, Bonnie Raitt, B.B. King. So my first 10 years, or 10 or 12 years, actually, we did all major shows.
And then
of course, you know, some of these big clubs came along, you know,
July 26, 1980 was the first time we played the Channel. And old school.
Really? So you know that and I don't, huh?
Well, you actually played the Channel 9 times, 2 of them were
better,
but you played, let's just go through them. July 26, 1980, January 22nd, 1981, April 18th, 1981 with John Butcher. The one on the 22nd was with the Stompers and John Butcher, and that was 81. And then another 81, April 14th, with Afternoon All Ages with John Butcher. And then March 30th, 82, with Duke and the Drivers. And then the next one was 84, because you were touring so much then. And that was your and the band. And then May 25th, 1986, then 84 and 85, you were touring heavily. And 86, wow. You had a Vietnam Veterans Benefit with John Messina opening, and that was...
Oh, I remember that, sure.
25th of 86. And then
now,
October...
Who was that with Messina?
That was with the Vietnam Benefit with John Messina at the channel. In October 25th, 87, another benefit, and this was for the Bikers Ball. And
I was going to say that was like the Hell's Angels.
Exactly, I was there.
I still have a shirt from that show, and it's crazy wild, you know, with all the HA logos and everything on it.
That's cool. And then February 14th, 1990, with Heavy Metal Horns. Biker's Ball. And
oh my God.
And so there was, you know, like I said, there were two or three benefits that you did later on, because you were just so established in every level. And now, now you're so established, you can do good shows that you want to do yourself instead of honing in.
And even today, Dickie James is still doing benefits. I mean, I've seen him at least a half dozen times in the last year. Veterans benefits all over New England, and it's
fantastic.
He's still the head performer with the key name on.
Yeah, you know, I started working for veterans in 1972. And I don't know if anyone started working for veterans before that. I was playing at the Orpheum, and this guy comes in and he says, would you help us raise money for Vietnam veterans? And I was kind of stammering. I said, well, geez, I don't know. He said, well, follow me. And I walked outside of the Orpheum, and you know where that is. And we walked down Tremont Street from the Orpheum to Boylston. He goes, there's one there. Another few feet, there's another one over there. And by the time we walked the distance from the Orpheum to Boylston Street, there were probably 14 veterans on the street with Dunkin' Donuts cups. And I said, I will work for those people. And and I lost fans. I got some hate mail. People thought I was supporting the war in Vietnam. They thought I was supporting the administration. But all I was doing was working for those veterans who were on the street, you know.
Well, you see that, and that's what your heart put
1972. So I eventually got a medal for that from the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
That was approved by
Obama, and I got that on 60 Minutes just because I'd been working for veterans since 72.
Excellent. No, you deserve it, kiddo. I mean, that is beautiful.
Incredible. And just so you know, James, the reason Dickie seems like he has such a great memory, he built this awesome website called Boston's Best Live Rock, which of course won the taglines for the channel back in the day. And what he did was he went back through the archives of the Phoenix for years and compiled a list on that site and find everybody that played the channel over the course of the entire time he was there. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I was pretty sure that wasn't off the top of his head.
I actually went through it again last night just to double check how many times and when you did.
Oh my God!
When I started flipping out when I saw all the benefit stuff, I'm saying, "This man's got it down."
I can't believe you know more about me than I do, for God's sake.
No. Well, I do. I do know something like. But the thing that's good is that you have gone and created something because of your soul and your heart and your spirit that people love. And that's the most important. You give them your heart and soul every time you get up there and play. And I heard on Friday you had Joe Mike come up and play, and I saw you doing a little bit of video there. I said to myself, James has got it down. He gave him the time of day to play his solo, but at the same time brought in that harp and creamed him. I loved it every minute of it. I say, yes, James, yes, yes, yes.
I always, you know, when I was growing up, you know, Junior Wells would let me sit in, James Cotton would let me sit in. And,
yeah.
And I actually played with Muddy. I did one night with Muddy Waters at Paul's mom.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And so I'm pretty old school, you know. If people come down and they want to play, you know, what the heck, get up there and play, you know.
Yeah.
Some of these bands, you know, well, no, you can't sit in because we're doing a song that we arranged. Well, screw that, you know.
I talked about before with John Butcher about these people, you know, that we used to, all of us, I had friends that would jam. I mean, we come over here with Fleetwood Mac and we'd be jamming with the Dead, people that, you know, Janis and stuff would come over and see us, and all kinds of stuff of the San Francisco scene would come out and love to play with us, you know, and we were just...
It was wonderful. That's what you're supposed to be able to do as musicians, and, you know, and there's some rock musicians who are really good musicians and they write good songs and they know how to play the particular song.
Yeah.
But when you ask them to just sit down and jam,
no way.
if they don't have a song in front of them, if they don't have something in front of them that they can play, you know, they're really good. They're selling records. They have nice songs, but they really don't know how to just sit down and make up music and jam. But like all the rock bands that are blues oriented, they all know how to jam.
No, they don't let the hair down so much. Now,
yeah.
One question before, I'm sure Sean's got a bunch for you, but one is from me, is do you remember the first experience with the channel, not just the performance, but coming in there to see someone that you fancied, that you wanted to get playing with, or you wanted to just see how they played? Like Jim?
Yeah, you know, we had a band house, well, I guess the band house is in Hingham, but then, you know, I lived in Cambridge for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure, you know, I have a lot of memories of the channel and seeing people there. I'm not sure. I think probably the first time I would have gone to the channel would have been if I was booked there.
Yeah, 1980.
Yeah, that might have been the first time I probably went there. But then, you know, once you discover that place, and it was... it was one of the most dangerous clubs in the area, you know, that and the Frolics and a couple other places. Dangerous meaning that things were going on in the dressing room that we didn't want the general public to know about, you know.
So Sean's so in charge.
The channel was definitely a wild and crazy place.
Well, it's big enough. It's big enough.
Yeah, go ahead. So I have great memories of it. I remember I saw Stevie Ray Vaughan there one time. That was great. You know, and it was just it was really I think for a while you'd have to say that, you know, of course the Boston music scene always centered around WBCN, but
I think for
a while you would have to say that the channel was really the access of the Boston music scene that everything else spun around, you know?
Well, the
thing is about...
Go on, Sean.
Sorry. I was going to say, the thing about the channel, which is great, is you could literally... It was huge, number one. It's funny that when I worked there, I was young. I didn't realize how big it was till after it was actually gone. Someone had told me it was actually the largest club on the East Coast back in the mid-80s, which is pretty crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
But... one of the greatest things was you could see new bands on a Monday or Tuesday, new bands, up and coming bands, and you could catch some of the bigger stars, obviously, on the national touring circuit. It would be either Boston or New York would be the first stop with the punk bands coming in from England, or in the bands, any kind of record label support, they'd be playing. That was the biggest club you could play in the area. But you'd also be able to see some of the big bands, like, you know, Eric Burdon would come through, and, you know, Blue Oyster Cult. Some of the bands kind of on the way back down from playing arenas. So it's really an amazing place where you could see these guys up and close, you know, superstars like James Brown and Roy Orbison. And I mean, there are so many over the years.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, you know what happened? You know what happened in a way? You know, the first 10 years or so that I was on the road with the bands like we mentioned, you know, with Steve Miller and Aerosmith and you know, Allman Brothers and all these people, you know, all of a sudden along comes Devo and the new wave music, and all of a sudden you know, the bands that are filling the arenas are now the Police and bands on that level. So some of the bands that you know, like Blue Oyster Cult, that had a pretty big following, then the big concert promoters are more interested in putting the Police in there. So then those bands went around and started playing these 1,000-seat nightclubs. And I remember I did a few shows with Aerosmith when Joe Perry left the band. And we were playing these 1,000-seaters in Long Island and New Jersey. There were these huge clubs. And the drinking age was 18. So good luck if you were 16. You could get in there and start boozing it up, you know. So that's what happened. And it was all about price point. If you had a club that held 800 people, you know, and you charged back then, you know, $15 to get in times 800 people, there was some money to be made there, you know. And back in those days, 15 times 800 was a lot of money.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And Stompers and Fools found out they could the same things. They could, you know, because it was like their hometown stuff. They played everywhere. But you did too, but not so much in the town in Boston. You played on the circuit, the big circuit.
Yeah, we were all over. We were all over.
And with the music that you play, you were definitely needed to be all over to give these people lots of love out there and stuff.
Yeah, we actually got taken off tours because in those days you didn't have to have a hit record to go over big. We actually got taken off some tours mid tour because the headliner wasn't happy with the way that the audience was responding to us. You know, sometimes we would get two encores and the headliner just one.
Yeah, right.
And thank God Barbara Skidell was my agent at Premier because she called us the Giant Killers and some act would bump us off of a tour. And I swear to God, by the very next day, she had us on another one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She was wonderful.
Powerful.
She was wonderful.
Yeah. Good agent. Yep.
No, we worked with her with Fleetwood. She was our agent with Frank Barcelona, but she took over the whole thing. And unbelievable lady. Really worked hard
for
if she loved that band. She loved that artist. She would work real hard.
She was a tremendously artist-oriented agent.
Yes.
And sometimes that's an oxymoron. But anyway, you know, the last time I saw her, I was, you know, I was in Johnny Winter's band for about 6 years. And the last time I saw her, we were playing out there at the Stephen Talk House, where I'm sure, Dinky, you've been in and out of there a million times.
With Teddy Slater, Teddy Slater. Sir.
Yeah. Well, this is after Teddy had passed, but don't get me started talking about that. But anyway, but I saw Barbara there. She came down to see Johnny Winter, and it was just great to see her again.
Did you ever play down at Steve Paul Scene in New York?
No, I never played the Steve Paul Scene. I mean, I know the whole story there with Steve Paul and Teddy Slater being a runner and all that stuff. I never actually played there. I did, you know, eventually it was impossible to be in this business and not meet Steve Paul.
Yeah.
But I never made it down to that Steve Paul Scene or whatever it was.
Yeah, we played as Fleetwood Mac, even though we'd played the Fillmore. We went down and played this little bitty club because it's just to me like an old funky blues club. You know, the actual
physical.
Yeah,
they had some great ones down there.
And we, a dressing room in the back, you know, on the top. It was no real dressing room. It was just where the beer was stashed.
That's where it's going to be, the beer stash.
and we had the Hells Angels drive all the way from San Francisco from Owsley. And
Oh my God.
They came outside. Teddy Slater's come running onto the stage. Grab me, I was just about to start the first set. And it's just, there's people who want to see you. They're not supposed to be in here or anywhere. So can you hide them in the back somewhere and stuff?
Oh, my God.
It was funny, and it was really the big boys of Hell's Angels, the real big boys. And they'd driven.
Yeah,
driven.
I, I was the house band for a little while at the Salem chapter when Larry was running it out there. And
oh, my.
I ended up doing a certain amount of work with those guys. I mean, eventually it kind of sunk into me, you know, some of the things they did for a living. And I just said, hey, guys, it's been nice working with you, but, you know, that's probably my last show with you.
Yeah. Sure. That's what you got to do. I mean, they came back to San Francisco, these guys, and then the whole crowd of Angels came to see us at the Fillmore that night, and the first night we played there. And
now, who was that? Was that with who was that with?
With the Angels. Well, we played with Fleetwood, 1969, around this time, you know, we played.
Well, my brother John, by the way, broke Fleetwood Mac. You know, that White Album came out, and every DJ and program director in America passed on it because Fleetwood Mac was a pretty straight ahead blues band. And when that record came out, which was so different than anything they did, a lot of music directors and program directors, and this is a true story, they didn't even bother to spin it. They just said Fleetwood Mac because they were moving on to like some of the more modern stuff. So Fleetwood Mac hired my brother John, who was vice president of Warner Brothers at the time, in charge of FM promotion, and Paul Ahern, and we all know Paul Ahern ended up managing Boston. And my brother John and Paul Ahern went to every station manager and every program director in the country and all the major stations and said, this is not just another Fleetwood Mac album. You know, you got to listen to this one. And they'd take him in and they drop the needle on the record. And these guys would go, whoa, listen to that. So then the record got back in rotation and the rest is history. My brother John has a platinum record given to him by Fleetwood Mac. And a signed poster that they all signed that said, "Dear John, thanks for breaking our record," and everyone in Fleetwood Mac signed it.
Was this
awesome?
Was this Albatross, or Orwell, or Peter Green's Black Magic Woman?
No, this was the White Album that actually broke them. Rumors or whatever it was called.
Oh, okay. You're talking years later after.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the record that made them an international act.
That's,
you know, that's
the later on for me. I'd already left and gone with the Birds. And
yeah, no, this is later. This is later.
Yeah.
And when Fleetwood Mac went from a one level band to like one of the biggest bands in the world.
Well, that was Stevie and Lindsay came in. Yeah, I remember that. I was still here, Dan. And Mick called me. He says, we've got a, because I was in the studio across the road from him working with Steely Dan. And Mick said, we're thinking about getting this lady and this gentleman, that this duo comes together for him. And I says, is Christine going to be all right with this? I went through this whole thing. Christine's going to be all right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we still keep in touch, you know, and that kind of thing. I mean, when you grow up with someone like that, you know, and it was John's birthday last week, and we keep in touch. I mean, we've gone through a lot.
Oh, good for you.
It's the way that I've been brought up. We keep in touch with the people I've got, even people going back to the club I used to own in 1965, 66.
I'm pretty much in touch with all my original band members, so you know,
wow.
We're like family, you know.
Wow.
If something happens, you know, we really are, you know, if something happens to somebody, maybe you get some kind of even like the flu or something, you know, we all find out about it. And I think I'll have to get you on this with all your expertise. Somebody brought up the idea about doing a show with the original James Montgomery band members, and it's something that looks like it might have life.
Sean, can we do that? Can we do that, Sean? Please.
That's
so we might do that. And I was thinking, you know, because I'm the guy that broke Duke and the Drivers too.
Yeah, that's right. I remember
We played their prep school. And I'm not going to get too involved, but they had access to something that we found entertaining in those days. Yeah. And
well, I'm sorry, James. I'm not going there because we've been there.
Yeah, me neither. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah,
I'll
really.
And so I put him on as an opening act when I did a series of hockey rinks. That's my Detroit accent, hockey rinks.
Hockey rinks,
because remember in those days in the summer, everyone put on these big shows. I did a couple of them with Def Leppard and everything. And everybody would play these hockey rinks. So I put Duke and the Drivers on all these shows to open up for me. And by the end of that summer, they'd seen like thousands of people. And they were a good band, you know.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, they had their own career that went well for them, and I still stay in touch with those guys too. I talked to Greg Morton probably a month and a half ago. Talked to Tom Swift probably a month before that.
Wow, 74, I had a moment with Steely Dan in Boston, and at the Orpheum. In 1974, the Duke and the Drivers we had open for Steely Dan in Boston at the Orpheum.
Oh yeah.
And still they were so good then. I mean, you know, the music and everything was just right on. Even Walter and Donald, well, Walter more than Donald, but it was wow, this is good. Let's see what we, you know, because it was like, again, like you said early on, it's outdo this band and outdo that band. But, you know, they already went through that problem when they opened for the Kinks when I first met them in 72, Steely Dan. And
definitely.
The Kinks, Ray kept saying, can't give them any sound check, you can't do any of that, lad. So I says, no, well, all right. So I made Walter and Donald and them and Denny, I said to Denny, I says, go up there, start playing, don't mess around, let me get a sound on you. And this was like as the crowd's coming in and stuff. And then I didn't know who the band was, you know. And, you know me, I mean, that's why I like the clubs and the channel, because you didn't know who was coming in. I mean, you had the big bands coming in the channel, yet you also had groups from the rest of the world, the world music stuff with King Sonny R. Day. You didn't know how this engineer is going to work. You didn't know how the band's going to work.
I forgot about that, yeah.
And it's a classic show. It's unbelievable. So
yeah, he's an African guy.
Yeah, it was just phenomenal. When you get to that kind of stuff, it's like, let me go back to Dearborn, Michigan. And Dave, who used to be a DJ at the Grandy Ballroom for Russ Gibb. And
the Grandy.
And I played with Fleetwood there, and we had Blue Cheer was the headliner, right?
Oh,
must have been the loudest band in the world. Peter Green says to me, okay, I'll do my 16 bass solo, but Dinky, Chris Adamson is my other partner on this, go around and plug everything up and let's blow the place apart. Well, we did. We absolutely nailed. They Blue Cheer didn't have a volume at all to cover that, what he did, because I was blowing plaster off the Grandy Ballroom. But we were just having fun. Until we got chased by Russ Gibbs' boys afterwards, after the cast I got from him. You know, and then
I haven't heard Russ Gibbs' name in so long. I played there with my high school band, the Montgomery Miller.
That's why I mentioned that, because I knew he had.
And then that's when I met Iggy, when he was still Jimmy Osterberg with the Prime Movers.
Detroit. That's right. Oh, you had fun.
He was still Jimmy Osterberg then. And then I took LSD, I think it was probably my junior or senior year, and I changed the name of the band overnight. I the name of the band was the Montgomery Miller Blues Band. And then the day after I took LSD, I changed the name of the band to The Great Cosmic Expanding.
Yes, yes.
And I started a light show called The Three Faces of Ohm. And we went and played the Grandy, and my guitar player's parents were filthy rich, so I told them to go out and buy an Echoplex and all whatever the latest gear was. So we played the Grandy Ballroom as The Great Cosmic Expanding. And then, so years later, I'm sitting here in Newport, and you know how the internet is. Get this article, about 10, 15 years ago, I get this article. From the, you know, every town had an underground newspaper in those days. From the Fifth Estate, the underground newspaper in Detroit. And it says, keep your eye out for the great cosmic expanding. They carried on in such a way that it reminded us of Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention.
I love it.
And then years later, I ended up opening shows for Frank Zappa, so it was great.
That's great. I love it. Oh, that's a good one. No, those days were classic days, let's put it that way. It continued in the Channel days because Boston had become the real hub of music for, as Sean would say, for the rock and roll changing into the punk, changing into the hardcore, a real creative time. But when you look back into the early times, like the early clubs and what have you, there was so much respect to going out there for $2 nights and stuff like that.
You could go out
there every night and have no problem. And even when it got to the Channel days, you could go over to the Rat and then you could go over into the Middle East or something and then come back at the Channel just to get the last act on, which was always going on around 1 o'clock in the morning. And
I know. You could play till 2 o'clock in the morning in those days.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Try and get in home after that.
In those days, I didn't want to go on stage until after 11. Now I'm home at 11.
11. I'm with you on that.
My shows now run, they put me on around 7 or 8 o'clock now, and which is great because we sell out and then my crowd goes home. And I told my agent, I said, I'm selling out everywhere, but my audience is so old. I said, oh, yeah, that's right. They're my age. it was unbelievable. And, you know, every single Ramones record release party happened in my apartment in East Cambridge, by the way.
I believe it. I remember that. I mean, the young lady, Barbara, and her thing. And I actually... The funniest thing, James, you'll like this one. We're up in Vermont. This is years ago. We're up in Vermont and at our friends Fred Houston and Eileen Houston's house. We come down to Brugger's Sunday morning so I get some bagels and then head home, right? I pull up and this woman comes up to me and says, and I didn't recognize her at first. And then Nancy goes, it's Barbara. It's Barbara Holliday. What's going on here? And she was up there working and doing stuff up there and living and what have you and having a good old time and what have you.
Where was that?
In Brattleboro, Vermont.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Sure. Yeah.
And
she moved up there for quite a while, you know. And I did a couple of shows for her daughter's high school up there.
Yeah,
Yeah, I brought Johnny Winter up there, and then I did another show up there with Jonathan Edwards at that theater, Latches Theater, I think it is.
Yeah, the Latches, I know that place. Unfortunately, we lost both Eileen and Fred over the last 10 years or so. Fred passed away last year.
And we lost Barbara last year.
Yeah, I was going to say that because she was in L.A. at the time. She's been writing to us and stuff, what have you.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
She's a fun lady. And, you had a good time. You had a good time period. Lots of things that were done right and lots of things, we could have done a second time and said, that would be better. But overall, it was great.
Absolutely.
Well, this is, you got some questions now, Sean? I've been now yatting long enough, I'm sure.
No, I'm enjoying the conversation. This is great stuff. It's funny, some of the themes, to go back over a couple of the points you talked about, James, how the industry's changed so much. Like back then you could take a band like Duke and the Drivers in a row because you could just do that. I remember like a similar plan with when John Butcher was on our last interview, he did the same thing. The Giles band, they weren't even signed, right? They're a local Boston band that they liked, and they wanted to get him on the road. They did the three nights at Boston Garden and the whole Freeze Frame tour. I mean, it was incredible that you had that kind of – the business was just so different back then.
Yeah.
One of the other common themes we talked about, you mentioned BCN as well, how vitally important BCN was, right? It wasn't just the clubs. It wasn't having the Phoenix paper. It was all the clubs working together. But BCN was such an amazing, powerful – station back then with the big wattage, but they also were very, it was very free for them. So they could play blues and they started playing rock, whatever they wanted. But they were a big, I know at one point they were really, really behind a few of your hit songs though, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They, you know, the one thing about BCN, you know, they understood that there were a lot of great bands out of Boston, yeah, and they always went out of the way to play their music. And even like bands that were undiscovered yet, BCN would play their stuff. You know, back in those days, these FM stations, BCN here, KCN in San Francisco, MMR, I think, was in Cleveland, and LIR in Long Island, and RIF in Detroit. You know, these radio stations really were the glue that held the music community together. And I remember being, I'm part of that movie, The American Revolution, the BCN documentary, and I actually produced the show that we did, where I brought in the folk people for the opening part with Tom Rush and Livingston Taylor, Kate Taylor, John Poussette Dart, Jonathan Edwards, and then we did a intermission, and I brought in Billy Squire and Al Cooper, Jay Giles, the Uptown Horns, Grace Kelly, Johnny A, you know. So, you know, that was all to celebrate the incredible station that held our community together.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dinky, you'll love this. 2 weeks ago, I did a live broadcast from the Odeon Theater in East Greenwich, and Sam Copper was the guy who came in and did the live broadcast.
I love it.
So I'm still in touch with all those people, too.
That's excellent.
Wow.
Excellent. The community that love the music, that everyone you just mentioned loves music, loves their style of thing, loves the people that they play with, and then hates them and then says, oh, I wish I was playing with them again.
and I will say this, you know, not just because you're on the line here, but you were a really important figure in music history back in Boston then too. Bringing B3s up the back steps of the Surf Nantasket, you were someone that everyone. Every single person in the community knew you and loved you, and it was you were an integral part of everything that happened back then. So I'm really privileged to be talking to you right now.
Well, thank you about that. But I mean, James, we're the same. We love the music. Especially for me, when I really loved the blues with not just because of the White Boy Blues we did with Fleetwood, but you know when we did with I had B.B. King over there in England and stuff, and we just. People like that, that was just phenomenal to work with. Phenomenal people.
Well, yeah.
Wonderful.
You know,
artists.
We talked earlier. I discovered the blues through the jug band. So the blues that I found out about earlier was, you know, rural blues, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, London Hopkins.
Well done. Well said.
You know, Fred McDowell, Mississippi John Hurt, those guys. But it took our English brothers and sisters to get Americans to wake up and understand that the music that was coming out of our country was the coolest music in the world. And a lot of people looked at the back of records by the Stones and the Beatles and everybody and said, who's this guy, M. Morganfield? You know, it turns out it was Muddy Waters. And who's this guy, McDaniels? It turns out it was Bo Diddley. So, you know, our English brothers and sisters had to kind of slap us on the face and go, hey, wake up and see what kind of music you've got in your country. Well,
that's why we went to Chicago and played on that tour that I'm talking about before with Russ Gibb and whatever. We went back to Chicago to make an album with Marshall Chess.
And oh, my God.
Peter Green wanted to have and Jeremy Spencer wanted to have all the different people that he admired to come in. So we got Willie Dixon playing bass, but he got all the people, all Hammy Nicks, all the different people that came that play on that album was phenomenal. And we all just bowed down to him. And then the story, the thing that I said before, but the story about that day is we were, Peter Green said to Marshall, I'd really like to go to a Southside Blues Club. And Willie Dixon heard that. Willie says, well, I'll take you, but you have to stay with me. You do not go anywhere.
And, yeah. And Peter. Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I used to go down there to Buddy Guy's checkerboard. And, you know, I remember one time I was playing in Chicago with Bonnie Raitt and I think Jackson Brown. And you know, we went down to the checkerboard and it was like.
Dangerous. You
know, and the Stells. Yeah, obviously, they had some of the best clubs in the world in Chicago on the south side and the west side. But I remember the night that my first night at the checkerboard, I was there with Bonnie and it was Buddy Guy's birthday, even though it's the middle of the summer or something, and he got one of those Superfly fur coats, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Kind of multicolored fur coat. It was 90 degrees outside and 110 in the club, and Buddy Guy was walking around with a big fur coat on. It was like that.
I love it. Well, what happened there that night was Peter had to go to the bathroom and he couldn't find Willie because Willie was talking to some of his friends. And he just went in there. The next thing you know, there's two guys walking in behind him, and then all of a sudden Willie came walking around him, and you don't touch that guy. You want to hear some blues, and they're all like, we hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
So Peter went up there on stage and started playing with him, and the place stopped. It was could hear a pin drop. And
after he
put his soul and played him a song there. I'm not sure which one. I wasn't there because he just went on his own with Willie. He didn't want anybody, no other person to go in there, just Peter. And Peter just lit the place up. The people in there just were ecstatic. They could not believe this white boy playing this stuff. It was just phenomenal.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing, you know, like I say, again, our English brothers and sisters, you know, they took that Chicago sound and they ran with it.
Yeah,
you know,
And
guys like John Mayall and, you know, I mean, before John Mayall, there was like Cyril Davies, who was like really the grandfather of British blues.
Yeah.
As you know, Cyril Davies and Long John Baldry to a certain extent,
Long John was a real character. I loved him. He was our MC on the BB
King. Don't try and lay no boogie woogie on the King of Rock and Roll.
That's it. The boogie.
He was trying to playing a kind of boogie woogie music.
That's common
to the American Negro.
It was funny seeing John Baldry up in Le Chaise, and next to him is this real short guy. Reg Dwight, which is became Elton, you know. But Reg Dwight was put in his place there with that lot and stuff. And he says, "Okay, we'll feed him some more booze, and we'll be all right then," you know, and stuff.
But
his MCing when we had him MC the BB King Fleetwood Mac tour with Duster Bennett playing one man band there, it was wonderful because he just was nearly in tears every night, every time he heard BB play the way he played for that particular audience. And then when we played the Albert Hall and Mick Jagger and them came down from the back and came into the back of the dressing room, Long John was like the key to, "I'll introduce you to BB King." and it was just... It was wonderful, and he was such a character to have around there. And what he used to come out with, like the boogie woogie, was like funny as heck because he was.
He was great. I did get a chance to sit in him with one time at Hancock Auditorium in Boston, downtown.
Downtown? Oh, I didn't know you. Oh, wow. But anyway,
it's part of the Hancock Building. It's underutilized, but it's a great venue.
Sean's been looking into venues. He's still promoting and doing that stuff, as you know, and he's still, you know, doing his security and still doing the The tickets for the major shows in town, not the major shows, but the major sports events and stuff like that. Yeah. And that keeps your tabs into everything, because all these artists that we all, you know, like you had the Cambridge scene going because that's where you lived. And it was fun. But remember, we had many a fun night we have to say was really good. And it created music. It was because it was also created really creative music with other people that you met along the way. And
I'm sure, you know, if you looked at all the young musicians who are playing in young bands in Boston today, it'd probably be this same sense of camaraderie. But when we were in Cambridge, it was, me, Bonnie Raitt, Pusset Darts, yep. writer John Turner,
yep.
Reeve Little, Peter Johnson.
Nancy used to book them all.
Pusset Darts, Livingston Taylor. And, you know, one night, you know, we had this big orange van with basically lawn furniture in it, and we'd drive around to the clubs and pick people up. And one night we go to Bonnie's house on Oxford Street, and the next night we go to my house in East Cambridge, the next night over to Pusset Darts. And then Cambridge was just a really a great place back then. A lot of camaraderie, and we all hung out together. And all of us, none of us had careers then. We were only 19, 20 years old. And every one of us in that group went on to have a career, so it was a lot of fun.
That's exactly right. Well, James, this has been wonderful. I have to say, it's been wonderful for me and Nancy, who's here with us too, and Sean. Sean's up north, but Nancy's in the studio with me, and she's just been excited that she's heard every one of the people that she used to book and stuff.
And Sean, I know that you're still putting shows together and still promoting and still bringing musicians together. So, we appreciate that greatly, Sean, because we need all the help we can get. So anyway.
Think about asking Sean when you try to put, and you get the band, the big band together that you want to with all the oldies and stuff. And work with Sean, because he'll find a place that's going to rock out for you.
You're one of the most beloved figures in the history of the whole Boston music scene. So I'm privileged to be here talking to you.
Well, we're privileged to be talking with you, James, because we love your music and you love you too. So, there's no ifs and buts. You perform and you create and you give the energy and love back to everybody on that stage and off stage in that audience. Have you got the last thing to say, Sean?
Well, I did tour with the Blues Brothers with Danny and Jimmy. I'm doing a bunch of stuff with Jim Belushi now. I've got a show coming up on December 12th in Newport, Rhode Island, where I have Jim Belushi, the Uptown Horns, the Rolling Stones horn section. I've got Barry Goudreau on guitar.
Nice.
And the Kevin James Graham from Team Reba on The Voice. It's a big show. And tell all of your fans and your listeners, to keep your eye out, because we haven't slowed down a bit. I'm still doing 100 nights a year, and our show is still kick ass. I model my band after Paul Butterfield and James Cotton.
Yeah,
and we come on with that energy. And my James Cotton documentary, by the way, which was one of five finalists in the Library of Congress Ken Burns Prize for Film. So we got to hang out with Ken Burns and down at the Library of Congress. But that documentary about James Cotton, we have Buddy Guy in it. We have Kev Moe, Jimmy Vaughn, Steve Miller, Bobby Rush. Anyway,
wonderful.
Just quickly, you can get that on Amazon Prime or Apple Plus TV or maybe 12 other platforms.
Yes.
It's called Bonnie Blue, James Cotton's Life in the Blue. So download that, and you'll see an award-winning movie about James Cotton.
I love it.
That's awesome. I knew you were, wow, ask that question, actually, James. I know you're working on that for this kind of a thing. You're working on quite a bit. I'm so happy to hear it's finally out. That's great. Good for you. Congrats.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Amazon Prime and Apple Plus.
Yeah, well, thank you, James, thank you for this conversation and interview that we're doing here. It's more of a conversation than straight interviews because we just know each other so well. We know each other well. We're not asking questions. Oh, what did you do yesterday? You know, and
Well, listen. The other thing is, now that we're back in touch, the number on my phone, I'm assuming, is yours. So I'll put it on my phone. And
perfect.
And let's stay in touch, buddy. I would love to see you again. And Sean, I see you occasionally, but. And I love you guys. Like I say, I'm thrilled to be part of your show, and let's stay in touch, guys.
Thank you, James.
Thanks so much, James. This is okay. Bye, bye, guys.
By the way, this is Two Pints in the Corner closing out. Thank you.